What and who lies on the other side of crisis? Whatever treatment is used, even if it's old-fashioned time, the easing of crisis is not a return to health, but only the first step in such a return. It is that dazed mixture of relief, exhaustion, and bewilderment commonly called the aftermath, a fragile condition, a thin soil in which hope may try to put down roots, a time of questing and questioning, which becomes, in no time-bound sense, since I take it to be a lifelong process, the questing and questioning of recovery. A feature of recovery that I don't think is talked about often enough is the intellectual challenge it poses. We have gotten better at bringing the heart into mental illness. How do you feel? Is asked routinely now. But strangely, for something we call mental illness, we still tend to leave the mind out of it. How do you think is still a rare question. Maybe this is not so surprising. To encounter a friend who has traveled to a far place and hear about the tears and frustrations, along with the laughter and comforts he found there, is less threatening than to hear him wonder how that other place may be making and unmaking who he is and what he finds here, now. Most people can imagine the emotional blow that trauma inflicts, and that is what most accounts focus on. But what has also been damaged, perhaps even shattered, is the personal narrative of self and life we are all telling ourselves, which must now resume with drastically altered prospects and circumstances. Simply put, serious mental illness poses a constant question that is very hard to answer, but which must be answered in some fashion. Who am I now in the light of that? What can I now expect? What can I do? Soon after my first admission to hospital, I entered a state of complete catatonia, either as a result of psychosis or the powerful tranquilizers I was put on, or most likely a combination of both. But before that, I have fragmented but clear memories of an exchange that kept recurring during my first intake interviews. It involved the doctors telling me, with regard to the wound I had given myself, what I called myself cesarean, and my beliefs about it, that it was a delusion, a hallucination, part of the psychosis. And I kept saying, with the monosyllabic stubbornness of a trapped person, "No, it's true." I think I kept repeating this until it was just a whisper, and then it became an internal voice. "It's true. It's true." You see, I had been guided by a vision that a rebirth was coming, that the person I had been was dying and had to die so that a new person might be born. "You're sick," they kept saying. "No, it's true," I kept saying. We were speaking from different vantage points, they from sickness, symptoms, and treatment, and me from existence, metaphor, and what I saw as salvation, so we couldn't understand one another. What I might say to them now, if I could travel back in time, is, "I'm sick, and it's true." What I'd done was violent and horrible and terribly distorted, with more violence and distortion to come. But it was also true, twistedly true, or, if you prefer, truly twisted. And true in the most literal way. A straight-A high school student, a good and likable boy whose future seemed promising, now lay bandaged and mute, drugged and shocked on a psychiatric ward, with, after a while, very little hope held out, even by the doctors, for his recovery. Clearly, someone had died. And then, 2 years later, working as a part-time dishwasher and living in a rented room, tramping about the city all day and night, scribbling poems on scraps of paper, restaurant napkins and placemats, and even the margins of dollar bills, hand-stitching little books, making collages out of curb-found objects, and feeling exultant, jubilant that at last I'd found the life and art I was meant for. Just as clearly, someone had been born. It is terrible, of course, to be unmade as a person, and exhilarating, and terrible to be exhilarated by your own unmaking. As I thought about this the other day, What flew into my mind, like a flaming arrow, was the famous war cry attributed to Crazy Horse. It is a good day to die. Which means, as I understand it, that it is also a good day to live. Especially if you couple it with the first sentence Crazy Horse is supposed to have said. It is a good day to fight. It is a good day to die. If it is a good day to die, it is a good day to live. And if it is not a good day to die, then probably it has not been a very good day to live. This, by the way, is not related by any neat corollary to suicide, which stalks through my book like a shadowy hunter. I won't generalize about suicide, which I think is talked about too glibly, when in fact it must be as various and complex as the people and moods that turn to it. I only want to say that I have known the impulse to exit life not as a good day to die, but rather as a day so bad to live that dying seemed the only way to end it. That is very different. Another figure that recurs in my book is not a shadowy stalker, but an amazed and dazed wanderer on a beach. Robinson Crusoe. At one point I talk about the frequent sense I have of stepping out from a mist to stare, alert and surprised at the present I find myself in. Crusoe mode, as Heather and I call this islanding in the present, has its positive aspect. Washed up on a new beach, you focus intently on the things about you. Grains of sand, a shell, the leaves of a new tree, a footprint. You are alive to the life about you in a way you scarcely could have been during the routine and tedium of the voyage. This sense of witnessing an ongoing miracle, and a newborn baby, if we knew how it thought, must also live in Crusoe mode, was one of the most striking results after I finally got out of the hospital. I hitchhiked across Canada with my friend that summer. It must have been a somewhat harrowing trip for him. I would only sleep an hour or two at night, and often saw strange things, such as the giant 2-meter-long crow that I saw swooping repeatedly at one ride's window. But luckily, my friend was a good sport, and even more luckily, a sound sleeper. I remember one day we were in a diner, I think it was in Kamloops, having breakfast, and I was sitting there after my scrambled eggs, watching my spoon glitter in a pool of sunlight. And my friend said, sounding surprised, "You feel good now, don't you?" "Yes," I told him, "and more than good, wealthy." He asked me about that, and I tried to explain. I was warm and comfortable. I'd been fed. I was free to sit on a vinyl chair and look about, listening to my friend, gazing at a spoon, watching other people. What more than these riches did I need? To a large extent, I've never lost that perspective. It's a permanent gift I received, a legacy of madness. Or perhaps a grateful ebullience that was always there, but that madness, or just hitting bottom, heightened. I'm aware of it standing here now, inside, out of the November elements, invited to talk to people, pretty confident I'll get a good lunch somewhere. I don't really need anything more, except I need to say something, or else you'll begin shifting uncomfortably in your seats. And then we'll all feel bad. And there's the rub. How to live in the moment but move to the next moment. A practical problem for all of us. How to live now but still be living tomorrow. Which I must have solved somehow, or I would be a skeleton grinning at a dusty spoon in a boarded over diner in Kamloops. How did I solve it, I wonder? How do I? I think perhaps, at my best, I solve it by becoming, by living as, a moving now, a moving readiness. A newborn on the move, as newborns always are, even when they're sleeping. A Crusoe with a plan, as Crusoe soon developed. Continued life does involve forward thinking, future thinking. But I have trouble with future thought. For a good and healthful reason, my tendency to marvel at the miracle of the present, but also for a more destructive one, which is a simple inability to believe I can have a future, that it won't be swept away by another trip through the swinging door of madness. My current psychiatrist, an excellent doctor, has given me much counsel on this problem, but a lot of it boils down to two of those simple words that call out for attention: as if. Live for today, but also as if tomorrow will come. Prepare as if you will be granted a future as well as a present. A tall order, but a sensible and necessary one. Doors are another metaphor that run through my book. I think of the altered states of madness as a door that, for someone of good mental health, should properly be a little sticky and resistant. But if it bangs open once, it will open more easily again. If it swings open many times, as it has with me, it starts to resemble one of those screen doors with worn-out hinges that flap at the slightest breeze. You have to learn to live with a door with loose hinges, which means the possibility of something coming in, or something, maybe you, going out. You have to learn to live with a door that is ajar. There are worse things. Permanently locked doors, for example. Being sealed out or in.